You're listening to Radio Influence.
Got him in the white trunks. He heard it.
Beautiful.
Oh, God.
That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the top. Wow. Hey, here comes a mission. And it's all over. It's nice. All over. First round knockout.
Big
is how Rich Franklin retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
UFC 212 took place on Saturday night in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and Max Holloway is now the undisputed UFC featherweight champion as he stopped Jose Aldo in the third round. Also, Claudia Gadelha has a stoppage victory over Carolina Kowalkiewicz, and Vitor Belfort wins by decision for the first time since 2007, nearly 10 years since the Phenom had gone to a decision. And we're going to recap this fight card here on this episode of the MMA Report Post-Fight Podcast on Radio Influence. Now, before I bring in Daniel, I'll let you know about our sponsor, Fight TV. Fight is your go-to app for MMA fans and practitioners, live pay-per-views, TV tapings, full-length matches, interviews, movies, and documentaries. It's your number one source of MMA, boxing, and pro wrestling video. Watch MMA, wrestling, and boxing live on the screen of your choice, phone, tablet, or TV using just the Fight app. Download Fight free today by going to Fight, FITE.TV/Radio Influence/. Once again, that is Fight, FITE.TV/Radio Influence/. Daniel, UFC 212 was an interesting night. What was the biggest surprise of the night? Max Holloway stopping Jose Aldo, Claudia Gadelha submitting Carolina Kowalkiewicz in the first round, or Vitor Belfort and Nate Marquardt going to a decision?
Well, Vitor, I saw there was Chase Sherman, who I believe is a UFC heavyweight, had a tweet where he said, everybody that retweets it, I will follow everybody that retweets this if Vitor's fight goes to a decision. And much like a promise for a number one contender in a UFC fight, he didn't deliver. But that probably tells you that was the most shocking thing. But honestly, man, what surprised me the most was that third round in the main event between Holloway and Jose Aldo. Aldo, again, for two straight fights early on, didn't really throw many leg kicks. It seemed like he was fighting at a much slower pace, and I was going to expect a fifth round, slobber knocker, and this was a great fight, but I definitely didn't anticipate Max Holloway coming out in that third round and not only beating a champion, not only beating a guy who I think we both consider to be one of the best, lighter weight fighters in the history of the sport, but to just downright demolish him in that third round. That to me was the most surprising, and it was obviously the first thing we'll think about when we look back at UFC 212. I mean, for you, where did you watch these fights, Jason?
I was at a local establishment here in Tampa, and it was it's always interesting to me when you go out and you watch these pay-per-views, and it really wasn't until about, I would say, the co-main event that actually people seemed to be interested in the fights. And literally the pay-per-view was on every television in the bar. And this is now the second pay-per-view. Two of the last three UFC pay-per-views I've gone out and watched at a bar. And it's always, to me, it's just very interesting to see how people react to the event. But I remember once this fight ended, me and my buddy looked at each other, and we both had the same thought. Where were the leg kicks with Jose Aldo?
Yeah, I wonder if anybody asked him the question at all. I would like to go back and see if that question was asked after the Frankie Edgar fight, because it's not like he was very active with the leg kicks early on. And I would assume it has to do with a high degree of confidence in his boxing, which if you're Jose Aldo, there's a good reason to feel good about mm-hmm. your boxing. But really, when you look at where the placement of – well, first off, the second Max Holloway got in that cage and he was next to Aldo, I felt so stupid picking Jose Aldo. I mean, the difference in the frame between these two, which I knew, everyone knew headed into it, but it gave me the same feeling, actually, that I got in the Eddie Alvarez-Conor McGregor fight the second they both stepped in the cage. Yeah. I'm like, there's something different in the frame of these two, but it was more pronounced to me in this fight. It just seemed like this was two fighters that established themselves very close in terms of skill-wise on the feet. And when you introduce the element that Holloway has the advantage of just fighting at a farther distance and he's bigger frame, that's almost insurmountable, especially if you're going to limit yourself and not use kind of one of the top skills that you've displayed throughout your career. I think you look at the first 65% of Jose Aldo's career and you ask people, what's the defining strike of his arsenal? I would say the answer would be leg kicks. Now it's become the jab, but for him to not use the leg kicks is a bit perplexing because I never got the sense that Max Holloway was going to go out and attempt a takedown, which is to me the one reason why any striker wouldn't attempt the leg kicks. I mean, for you, Jason, if you're putting on your tinfoil cap, why don't you think Aldo is using leg kicks in this one?
Makes you wonder if there's an injury. I mean, that's the thing that comes to my mind. And, you know, against Frankie Edgar, it makes sense that Jose Aldo would, you know, not throw the leg kicks in fear of that Frankie would try to take the fight to the ground. But with Max Holloway, you know what Max wants to do. Max wants to have there, and he wants to have a stand-up matchup. So, to me, that was just odd. And I just had to pull up Jose Aldo's Wikipedia page. To me, it just doesn't seem like Jose Aldo's older than 30 years old.
Does it seem like he's older than 30 years old? I mean, he fought like he was the same age as Vitor in this one.
Yeah, I think it's just because we have seen Jose Aldo for such a long time, and we've seen Max Holloway for a long time as well. But when you think of Jose Aldo, if you would have said to somebody like at the bar I was at last night that guy is only 30 years old, I don't know if people would have believed me.
Yeah. And I tell you what, when Holloway turns 30 years old, I think we're going to have the exact same discussion, because that's what happens when, like, your career to casual fans kicked off like 8 years ago. I feel like 8 years ago, 7 years ago, that's when Jose Aldo was having a lot of success in the WEC. And that is, I mean, I knew he was 30, obviously, because when a fighter is at high profile, you're constantly aware of what his age was. But he didn't necessarily fight like what you would assume a 30-year-old fight like, and that makes a lot of sense because in a sport like mixed martial arts, it's not so much – well, in any sport really, football, basketball, baseball, it's all about how often you're in the cage and how many training camps you go through. And he's gone through so many training camps that I would assume his mixed martial arts quote-unquote age is more like a 34, 35-year-old.
Yeah, you know, and Andre Pedernares has kind of talked about, and Jose has talked about this, the tough training camps they do put in there. But when another thing I think about when I think about this main event, biggest winner of the night's got to be Frankie Edgar.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about it the last time Edgar fought against Yair Rodriguez, right? It seemed like the two. A lot of times we come. It's hard for us, right, to come up with matches for the next championship. It's like, well, it could go this way, it could go the other way, but this is clear. If Aldo would have won, it would have been a lot more murkier. You probably would not have gotten an Edgar title fight. You probably would have got a Cub Swanson title fight. That's probably why Cub Swanson was a part of the FS1 panel.
Yeah.
And poor Cub, probably a little sad as he interviews Max Holloway. But clearly with this win, I mean, this is like Claudia Gadella. This is like a new strawweight champion is the best thing for Claudia Gadella, or a new flyweight champion is the best thing for Joseph Benavidez. Frankie Edgar, one of those fighters that's put himself in the Benavidez vortex, the Uriah Faber vortex, where he is either the second or third best guy in the weight class. It's just a matter of Aldo has had his number twice in a row. So Holloway versus Edgar. And I mean, where does this fight take place, Jason? I know Max Holloway has been on board about going to Hawaii, which the first time that happens, I think would be amazing to have a championship fight in Hawaii. Would just be huge. But I guess there's a reason why we haven't had a championship type fight in Hawaii, right?
Yeah, we got a question from B. Abraham 1988 on Twitter. His first question was, does Holloway have enough clout to make his first title defense in Hawaii? And also saying, can the UFC do a show in Hawaii? One of the things I've always heard is that there's just logistical nightmares of trying to do a show in Hawaii. Now, it's a 6-hour time difference from the East Coast. So there's that. So you're talking about if you want to do a pay-per-view in Hawaii, you're talking 4 o'clock local time. Do you think you can draw an audience in there? But I've also heard there's, you know, some other logistical issues of why a fight card would not happen in Hawaii. But, you know, if you're going to go to Hawaii, you know, obviously Max Holloway being in the main event, and if PJ Penn can win later this month at that fight card in Oklahoma City, having PJ Penn on that card would make all the sense in the world. But everything I've always heard is that there's just too many logistical nightmares for this actually to happen.
Well, I would be absolutely shocked. If Holloway has a long title reign, I'd be stunned if we don't see a fight card in. I mean, we're going to Singapore in a couple of weeks. I would assume we could.
So are you getting up at 3:30 Central Time in the morning to watch that prelims?
I don't know if you know me, Jason, but I party hard and I never fall asleep. Like at 3:30, that's when I'm arriving from my night out on the town with Teruto. I have them on FaceTime the whole time, and we go bar hopping. But I'll be awake. I was looking at the sports arenas for Hawaii. There aren't a lot, at least on the Wikipedia. Maybe there are some that aren't on the Wikipedia. Like the only one that I saw where it was like, oh, this could theoretically happen is like where the University of Hawaii plays football, which, I mean, I would assume they don't sell out Hawaii Rainbow Warrior football. This is like it's Aloha Stadium. It's like 40,000+, I would assume even more for a UFC. Like that would be super hard, I think, to sell out for a UFC card. But I tell you what, like if you haven't gone to a market ever and you're the UFC, and I don't know what I have to assume that mixed martial arts is a big deal in Hawaii, given how great BJ Penn has been. And I guess you think back to that promotion with him and Condit Rumble. I can't remember the name of the promotion, but it seems like it's hot there. So I could see them attempting to do a stadium show. But they would have to do Holloway title fight, obviously, and they would absolutely, without a doubt, have to do 39-year-old BJ Penn. I mean, at that point, he'd be 39 years old, I would assume, or 40 years old. So you got to do a BJ Penn fight, which is sad, very sad. Maybe he can fight Vitor. You got to do a Holloway fight, but I would actually advise the UFC to go do that stadium show. It's probably, I mean, it's a risky proposition, but isn't that kind of, could, like the opportunity to create a special moment and do a show in a big time venue in Hawaii with a hot crowd with Max Holloway as champion is something you got to grasp when a lot of these venues and cards kind of are forgettable.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing you have to do. If the UFC, you have to be a box office success, because obviously in the pay-per-view business right now, Max Holloway is not going to draw a lot of people to the television set unless he was fighting Conor McGregor, and I don't think we're ever going to see Conor McGregor again. So to me, it makes all the sense in the world to go to Hawaii with Max Holloway. I just, from things I've heard in the past, there is some logistical problems there. You know, so we talk about Frankie Edgar being the biggest winner. Cub Swanson has to be the biggest loser because he needed a Jose Aldo win. But what's next for Aldo? And is it Cub Swanson? Is that the fight that you go with?
Yeah, what's next for Aldo? I think, you know, Cub Swanson was a loser because he's not getting a title fight. But I tell you what, a main event against Jose Aldo, like, that's a big spot. I mean, that's probably first off, I think Aldo versus Swanson is something you main event with on TV, for sure.
Yeah,
you could do a strong co-main event with that. That would be something real strong. I mean, the biggest issue for this UFC pay-per-view card was the co-main event was weak with name value. And the main card fights didn't matter. The card itself was great. So a fight like Aldo Swanson is actually just a beautiful number two on any pay-per-view card. But I think you do that on TV. There aren't a whole lot of fights that make sense for Aldo outside of that. Because like a lot of the guys you would think of for him to fight that would be super exciting, like Anthony Pettis, like Yair Rodriguez, Chan Sung Jung, they are either coming off losses, and some of them a lot of losses, like Pettis, or they've already fought Jose Aldo. And Swanson has actually already fought Jose Aldo, but Aldo-Swanson is a fight where you're guaranteed that whoever wins that bout, you have the next challenger for the winner of Edgar Holloway. I mean, is there anything other than Swanson to you that you would go after, Jason?
I mean, that's the fight to me that makes the most sense. You know, Chan Sung Jung, he just pulled out of UFC 214. Due to an injury, so unknown about the timetable there. You know, Pettis is now at 155. I think the question maybe you have is Jose Aldo's next fight at 155. Is he at that point in his career where he's done trying to cut down to 145 pounds? But to me, if he's at 145, I think the Cubs Swanson matchup makes the most sense. You know, because I think stylistically it's a fight that should entertain the fans. I think that could easily be a headliner of a fight night card or even a co-main event of a pay-per-view.
Dude, I love the idea of him at 155, actually. I don't know where he is right now. He's probably in some country I can't name, hanging out with the coldest people on the planet. But if you get Nate Diaz to fight Jose Aldo at 155, that would be kind of an awesome fight. I mean, you may want to use Diaz for something else. Where is Nate Diaz? You know where Nate Diaz is, Jason?
Waiting for Conor McGregor to fight him.
He's waiting. Do you think when Conor comes back, they do the trilogy? Because if that happens, then obviously he don't care. He's not picking up the Aldo phone. But
to me, from a financial sense, that's a fight that makes the most sense for the UFC to go with Nate and Conor. But I was talking with my buddies last night about the whole Conor thing, and no matter what, I think for the UFC, if this thing happens, you almost want Conor to lose, because then that could end the whole, I mean, you know, Stipe's talking about he wants to fight a boxer. I think if he goes out there and gets wrecked by Floyd, it kind of stops that whole MMA fighter wants to take on a boxer. But based on how much money Conor will make with that fight, does he ever fight MMA again?
Does he, if he gets embarrassed by Mayweather? Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think Conor, to get as good as McGregor has in the featherweight division, like, you gotta just absolutely be addicted to the sport. And he's smart enough to not let that addiction to the sport get in the way of taking care of his family and taking care of his finances and being a hell of a bargainer. So, win or lose, well, especially lose, I think we see him back in the cage. I mean, I just think at 28 years old, there's probably, I mean, the only thing better, I think, for McGregor, the better experience than actually coming out and fighting is the paycheck. That's probably the best experience for him. But the second best has to be coming out to the crowd and just doing what you do best. So I would assume Jason, win or lose, he returns to mixed martial arts. But if he does win, I mean, his next fight is probably going to be against Manny Pacquiao. I mean, that's going to make him more money. Yeah, that's such a weird thing that you almost, if you are the MMA, you know, if you're UFC, you probably are hoping for a McGregor loss because, yeah, if he comes out there, shocks the world. I mean, he pulls off the greatest upset in just the history of sports, right? Like, that has to be the biggest upset we've ever seen in combat sports. I don't know.
Oh, no. Yeah, no question.
So, I mean, that would literally be something we teach in history books, I think, in 100 years, is McGregor beat Mayweather.
Look, if he beats Mayweather, and I think that there's literally a 5% chance of that happening.
I think less than that, but yeah.
But if he beats Mayweather, so you know there's a rematch.
Yeah.
You'll never see Conor in MMA again.
Yeah, you're right.
Because,
yeah.
I mean, you think about how much money he would make on the first fight. Times that by 3 for a rematch.
Yeah. Yeah, you know why? Yeah, I tell you what, you know why he won't return? Because you had the guy in the main event tonight ask for money, ask $50,000, and then you had the fighter in the co-main event excited that she can get a car.
Yeah, that's not a good look.
That's not a good look. And, like, I was thinking about this. I was reading about the UFC Performance Institute. I'm like, that's a hell of a lot of money. It's a great deal, right? The Performance Institute or whatever.
I tell you, I talked about this on the Insiders podcast. If I was a strength and conditioning coach in Las Vegas, I would be concerned about my business.
Yeah.
Especially if you're in the business of, you know, working with MMA fighters. Like, to me, I would sit there and be applying to work for the UFC.
Well, so, okay, first off, that Performance Institute is only open to UFC fighters, right?
Correct. And there's no cost to the fighter.
So that's, again, what I'm saying is, when you aren't paying your fighters well, as great as that Performance Institute is, like, you get what I'm saying here? Like, I mean, that's a lot. That's a big cost. Like,
like earlier in the night when Brian Kelleher, when he got his win and he's doing his incredible post-fight interview, and he's talking about, you know, Dana, change my life, give me a bonus. To me, that says a lot about where this sport is at the regional level. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, I think that for, you know, probably a majority of people listening to this podcast, if someone hands you $50,000, that's going to change your life. And maybe it's just, you know, hey, you have a mortgage and you throw $50,000 to the bank and all of a sudden that mortgage goes down big time, but you know, it's going to change everyone's life. But I think in terms of that casual sports fan, when they hear that, I can only imagine what they think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think some of the top independent wrestlers in the world have to make more money than UFC fighters, other than the champions. Like these guys, there's some wrestlers called the Young Bucks. They aren't in the WWE, but they are making a lot of money off of independent wrestling. So comparing UFC fighters to like independent wrestlers, top independent wrestlers, and the top independent wrestlers are making more money, that is kind of a problem. I mean, this is a developing sport. You're still building the foundation, but as much as you say it's a developing sport, you get Snoop Dogg to perform at some BS Fighter Summit where some drunk guy is talking to you, and you do a performance institute, and it's like, man, all the money, and you sell the promotion for so much money. There are some significant dark clouds over the UFC, and a lot of it has to do with the UFC and the fighters not being on the same team, if that makes sense.
But will the fighters ever come together?
Yeah, and Leslie Smith's going to be the one in front and center, man. I love the question she asked Kobe. I mean, I think so. I think so for sure. Not this year, I would assume, but this is trending in a bad way. Multiple different ways. Both fighter pay, buzzer pay-per-view, stuff like that. It is trending negatively, and maybe there'll be a boom, Jason. There has to be a boom, I would say. People love fighting, but it certainly – I would love to know what the buy rate for this one was, because when I did – and I loved this card. Again, the card was great. The main card was super entertaining. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But I will say when you press purchase and you spend $50 for SD or $60 for HD, there's a part of you that feels empty inside. The first three fights you get are Eric Silva, Yancy Medeiros, Paulo Barrichina, Olawale Bambose, and Vitor and Nate Marquardt.
You feel like you're paying for an FS1 card.
Uh-huh. There's some strategies that are very bad, but think of this strategy. This is a stupid strategy, but I'm going to offer it to the UFC. Ready? It's called give and then take. So give to your audience. You identify every single person that paid money for UFC 212, and you give them UFC 213 for free. Yeah. You just call them and you email. Like Forrest Griffin shows up to your house and he's like, you know what? You get to watch UFC 213 for free. That would be, if I was a person, I would be hooked for life because, $50 for this card, $60 for this card is, how do you justify that to your wife or your husband, you know?
Yeah, that's tough to justify. What I thought was kind of interesting was on Friday, I went on to the UFC bar website, which tells you what places are confirmed to show it, you know, what places are not confirmed. And when you see not confirmed, it's places that had showed the previous pay-per-view. And the reason they're not confirmed is either A, they're not showing it, or B, they have not paid for the pay-per-view at this point. And here in the Tampa Bay area where I live, within 25 miles of my house, there was 17 places that showed 211 that were not showing 212.
Wow. That's astonishing. I mean, first off, that's astonishing that there are 17 places around your house that are – I guess that's the difference between me and you, because you live in a bigger, you know, area than I do.
I'm in a top 20 media market.
Yeah, you're in a top 20. Yeah, yeah. So, and that was Miocic Dos Santos. That wasn't a McGregor fight.
But, you know, like you look at 212, and I was thinking about this yesterday. The UFC played with fire with this one, because what would have happened if they would have lost the main event?
Oof. If they would have lost the main event,
it would have become a fight night card.
It would have become a fight pass card. What's the difference between if they lost the main event, what's the difference between the main event with Kadela Kovalevich versus the home card? What's the difference? I mean, they're really, I mean, and again, UFC 213, if you look at that main card, holy moly, that is just, that is delicious. But, I mean, the elephant in the room is, what if you put Aldo Holloway main event UFC 213 with that fight? Then you got a gangbuster out of fights. Then you got, that's what you, and that's what happens. Look, cards like this, and it's a weird thing because we have to juggle two things here. We have to be honest and be like, this card was great. It was super entertaining, but the fights, I mean, like I said, a lot of the fights didn't matter. In the grand scheme of things, you didn't have a lot of top 15 fights. You did have one on TV, but that fight sucked. But for the UFC, like, when you do an event every week of summer, this is literally what's going to happen. It's they're causing their own issues here.
Yeah, you know, you gotta, you know, and that's why I think the UFC needs to trim down to 8 or 9 pay-per-views a year, because, you know, it's like I say, you know, you got, they have to make pay-per-views great again. We need more pay-per-views like UFC 211. We don't need pay-per-views like, well, you know, I was overall pretty entertained by UFC 212, but yeah, it was, you know, it, what drew me to the television set was Holloway and Aldo, and it was what we expected. You know, Gedalia and Kovacevic, you had told me that fight's in the first round, I would have said you're crazy. I just didn't see this fight ending via stoppage, but unbelievable performance by Claude Gedalia.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's like the best thing that could have happened for her, because she had two awesome fights with Ioana Jędrzejczyk, and when you lose two in a row to the same fighter, it's hard to call for a rematch. But to be completely real with you, I'm kind of looking at the way she just straight up handled Kovacevic, and I will say, prior to Claudia taking down Karolina and submitting her, I really thought Kovacevic showcased some nice, like, confidence in her stand-up. She looked very active, switching stances, etc. So she looked improved. It's just the way Claudia Gadella just ran through her. I'm actually more excited for a third fight against Ioana than really Ioana's fight against Nama Yunus. I think and the next fight has to be, to me, Nama Yunus, Jędrzejczyk. And I think Claudia's going to get another fight before she takes on Ioana. But Claudia Gadella has just defined her role as the number one fighter in the division that doesn't have a championship. And I like the way she cut her promo afterwards, and she talked about how she's a new fighter. I think that's one way to sell yourself. And it's not so much selling yourself with the words, it's selling yourself with what you're doing in the cage. So I didn't expect that, but I did think, even heading into this one, Claudia Gadella has really defined herself as a women's strawweight in her own tier, in between Ioana and then all the other strawweight challengers.
I just hope the UFC gets behind her and tells her story. This is a fighter that has left Brazil, has moved to the United States. If you watched, I'm not sure if it was the Embedded show or the Countdown show, it was one of the two where she talked about, I think it may have been Embedded, where she's talking about living in the States and how much she loves to drive. And apparently she's been pulled over 5 times for speeding in the United States because she just loves speed. But I would just hope the UFC gets behind her in terms of what's next for her. And you look at, you know, that top 10 in the UFC strawweight division, there's no one that sticks out. Maybe Tisha Torres.
Yeah. I could see that. Are her, she's, what's up with the Jessica Andrade? Do you know what she's up to?
I know she was at the fights last night. I mean, I think that's another fight that would make sense. But if you're the UFC, is that, I think Jessica Andrade, I ultimately think she's a 125er.
Mm-hmm. Yep. She's a huge fighter, but I don't know if she would be able to beat Claudia. I mean, maybe you don't want to ruin the steam of Andrade, have her lose back-to-back fights. But I do think that would be an exciting bout. But, I mean, there is a lot of these fighters in the women's strawweight division, as you look at it from, like, 4 through 15, really, other than Cynthia Calvillo that I can see right now, they have had a lot of issues with the losses on their resume, a lot of, like, nearly getting to the ceiling and then getting pushed off by Ioana or whenever challenger. So I don't know what's next. Whatever it is, it's going to be – the storytelling is going to be all surrounding around Claudia. Just to reiterate what you said here about UFC and taking advantage, What I will say is the personalities of the fighters on top of this are just great. Max Holloway, amazing personality. Sometimes he talks a little too fast. It's hard to understand him. But I loved his personality. He had a great post-fight interview on FS1. A little awkward with Cub Swanson there. Claudia, just a great personality too in her interviews. The way she would do her answers reminded me of like on Saturday Night Live, they have a Weekend Update sketch where they have like the Jewish kid at his bar mitzvah. And he always laughs at the very end, like he's reading something, like a speech he prepared, and he always laughs at the end. And she like gives her answer, and then she just like laughs, like she just said the funniest thing. And something about that is interesting. But I want to close this by saying Karolina Kovacevic is like a star in her own right. Like she's got, I mean, you look at the UFC embedded, you want to do some subliminal subtext of the six episodes. She has to have been the cover photo for like four of the six. Yeah, that tells you a lot. I like the way Kovacevic was just like chilling in the corner. I think John Anik
yeah.
said that. That was amazing. I love it. I mean, I think all these fighters have just great personalities, and it's really hard to sell them because there are a million fighters. But if the UFC could figure out some type of formula to get people aware of who these fighters are, they do have an opportunity to get more business, I would say.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, and I talked about it on the preview podcast. I just hope that the UFC gets behind the winner of this fight, and we'll see if that happens. Vitor Belfort gets a decision win over Nate Marquardt. A lot of people, including myself, had Nate winning this fight 29-28. But not surprised that Vitor got the decision here.
Yeah, this was a phone checker. You know, the fight you watch and you check your phone, you look at it, the screen, you check your phone again, and that impaired my judgment on this fight originally. You told me you had Nate winning. I had Vitor winning, but I wasn't like eyes glued to it. So I went and rewatched it, which was like a bad idea because, oh God, this fight kind of sucked. Like it was not much happened at all. And rewatching it, Jason, I'd be interested to see what your scorecard was. But I thought Nate won the second round and I could see him win the first round, although so little happened in that first round. I could also see an argument for 10-10. I could not see a 10-9 for Vitor in the first round. Round two was a little closer, but I thought Nate won that. And then round three, to me, I thought Vitor Belfort won that. So I either had it for Marquardt or a draw upon second viewing. How did you score the fight?
I have to go back and watch it a second time, but just the first time watch, I just thought Nate did a little bit more than Vitor. I mean, Vitor was... I, you know, how much of this was for working with Faraz Zahabi, much more tentative, much more patient fighter. He did have that one little outburst there in the second round. But, I think the one thing that when I watch Vitor, it you see, you know, and I use it the time, you know, I use it, the cliche father time catch up everyone. And to me, it's no question. It's caught up to Vitor. This is a guy that, you know, came in this fight ranked number 11. And we talked about it in the pre-fight podcast. I don't know how many guys you could realistically think that Vitor beats in the top 10.
Yeah, not a whole lot. Maybe he can now, but the fights will kind of suck because he fought like you could see the Faraz Zahabi influence. It was real technical, real efficient, real like I'm going to win by not allowing my opponent to do anything. So fighting with that approach could lead to some success against fighters that don't get after it. Like that could take place, and that kind of changes the way I think about it. But realistically, looking at the top 10, I mean, no one in the top six, I think Vitor would be able to beat. And I mean, the first guy that comes to mind where he might be able to win, I wouldn't pick him though, is Anderson Silva.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a fight that I was watching the watch list with Sean Shelby and Mick Maynard, and John Anik asked McMaynard about that, and it seemed to be that was a fight that the UFC really has never tried to book, and there's a lot of debate on whether either one of those would actually take that fight. But to me, if you're going to do that fight, the time would be now to make that fight, but Vitor gets a win there. Also, this main card have Paulo Borrachinha get a win over Owolowe Bambuse. A fun fight to watch there. I think we definitely have to get invested in Paulo Borrachinha. And if you're the UFC, do you just continue having him fight in Brazil, or do you try to bring him to the US to kind of raise that profile?
Has he never fought in the US?
No, everything's been in Brazil.
If you're in Brazil, what's the drug testing like? Like, do you get tested randomly still?
Yes. Yeah. There. Yeah. USADA goes down there.
Paulo Borghina is freaking huge. Like,
it's interesting you bring that up because my buddy, he's like, the radar's going off, man.
I mean, I would love to see the numbers on fighters. Okay, so when a fighter gets tested, they have to go to like a local place, right? Like, it's not like they outsource. USADA doesn't fly out people, right?
They do.
They do. I feel like that would impair them from going to international countries every time.
Oh, I'm sure they probably have a contract with a group of people down in Brazil that handle that. But
probably right.
But I know anyway. If it's not USADA, typically that's a situation where a commission calls up a fighter and or his manager and says, "All right, you got 24 hours. This is the nearest place to go to. You know, that's where you take the test at. Where USADA, they physically come and see you. Which more times than not, you hear that they wake you up at 6 o'clock in the morning.
That absolutely sucks. The only worst thing is you wake up, you got to watch a Singapore card. But Paulo Borghina is the next Vitor Belfort because we started off his fight talking about this. But there's no reason for us to talk about this other than your casual fan watching will be like, that guy looks like a bodybuilder. He looks huge. That's probably going to be an issue for him against better 185ers, but not against Olawale Bambosa, who I'm just I'm on board with. This guy. This guy is a madman. I mean, that first round was awesome, and he starts out the second round doing like tomahawk chops. I don't know if he practiced that in the gym. It was the most ridiculous thing in the world. I fell in love with this fight. I mean, this fight featured up-and-coming middleweights and for Olawale, probably, you know, downward-moving middleweights. But this was a fun bout, not one where you come out of it thinking both guys are going to be superstars, but one where you come out saying, I really want to watch Paulo Borghina fight again, and I really want to watch Paulo Borghina fight again. You know what I don't want to watch again, Jason?
What's that?
A man's toenail being clipped off.
It's a funny thing you bring that up there. Did you see the tweet from Angela Hill?
No.
Where she took a screenshot of that entire scene and she goes, I've never wanted to drink a Budweiser so much. But as I'm sitting there at the bar and, you know, they have this, we call it a close up of him trying to trim off his toenail. Mm-hmm. The bartender looks at me and goes, ooh, why would you show that?
Yeah, dude. Yeah, imagine all the big screens across the country, those huge screens in Buffalo Wild Wings and in bars, and you just got a dude's
foot. Could you imagine? So, you know, guys at home, you know, wife is comes out of the bedroom, and she walks in right as that's on the screen. What do you think the wife says to the husband? What the hell are you watching?
Dude, I love it, man. I love weirdness. I love it when like producers take big risk in sporting events, because sporting events, I will say this, if you're doing a live production, you are usually not rewarded for taking risk. You know what happens when you take risk? People get mad at you. And I'm sure some people probably, I would love to see the back and forth on headsets and the production crew after they did that shot. Cause like, it's, you know, it's much like a fight when you're producing a sporting event. Like, you're making these calls, like you don't think about it, you know?
No, yeah.
And so personally, I love it.
My first thought was like, does no one have toenail clippers?
Well, my thought was, how is this not checked beforehand?
Now, one of the things you do see when they get into that fire checkpoint is, you know, the referee that's not working the fight is the inspector. And one of the things they do look at is their fingernails.
Don't necessarily
see him looking at the toenails, though.
It's not one that you think of. Speaking of refs, I have some thoughts. I mean, before we get into, like, maybe some of the stoppages, because there was some stoppage controversy, Jason, like.
We had a really bad early stoppage, and we had a really bad late stoppage.
Yeah, you thought the Aldo stoppage was perfect, right?
No problem with that one. The Madero stoppage was awful. And then does Johnny Eduardo, like, owe Mario Yamasaki money or something?
That was actually Fernando Yamasaki. He took over Mario's body. It's like a, it's like an evil ghost. That was bad. That was really bad, Jason.
That was like I was watching the prelims at home, and my wife was sitting next to me, and she just goes, "Are they going to stop this fight?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's just that was just an awful, awful late stoppage.
I mean, the biggest controversy to me is that Osiris Maia isn't Damian Maya's brother. Like, I Googled this and stuff, and, you know, I even Twitter searched his name. And there's no, like, confirmation that they're not brothers, but they look, like, super similar to me. Like, Osiris looks like just his Damian's older brother. And my conclusion is they're not brothers. Like, I went to his Instagram, and there's no pictures of him and Damian. So I guess they're not brothers. I think Mario Yamasaki is like the god in Brazil refereeing community, because apparently him and Ed Hardy were trained by him.
When I saw that Eduardo Hardy was working this fight card, I was like, oh man, here we go.
Yeah, poor guy.
But at least, I guess the good thing is, at least the controversy of his fight card has nothing to do with the unified rules of MMA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's always going to be the thing. And it's kind of annoying that they need to do it, but every time the fight pass, they start off letting you know about the rules. Like, isn't it kind of like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, right when you hear John Anik say that, you're like, oh man, here we go. But one of the things you hear is that the UFC and Bellator may start avoiding places that don't have the new unified rules of MMA. Because I think ultimately in the day, you feel bad for the fighters because, you know, one week you're in Brazil and they don't have it. Another week you're in California and they do have it. I mean, it's just you feel for the fighters more than anybody else.
I don't think that's going to happen, man. I don't think you can look at the way this crowd was and not come back to Brazil. I mean, this crowd was awesome.
Yeah, no, you're going to keep going down Brazil, but, you know, I could see maybe there's a little pushback by the UFC to make sure these unified rules of MMA go into effect.
Yeah, they need to put more money into some type of lobbying effort. And, I mean, just thinking back to the way Jeff Blatnick and John McCarthy went back in the very beginning writing the rules, something similar to that. One last refereeing thing I want to bring up to you is, I can't remember what fight this was. Maybe you can. But and we see it all the time. And it's like a weird thing. When a guy got eye poked and he stopped the fight without the referee stopping the fight.
Jim Wallhead.
Yeah.
That was a pretty nasty eye poke, which, first off, the referee's got to do a better job of seeing that eye poke. I mean, once, you know, and you do understand where the referee says, hey, I'm the one that stops the fight. You're not the one that stops the fight. I totally understand that. But also, I mean, that was a pretty bad eye poke where immediately he says he can't see, which I'm like, oh, man. Right when you say that, you really risk the chance of the referee just stopping the fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could also see Jamal had he flipped the switch. He realized that he said that, and right away he was eager to get back in there. My solution to that is because either Cruz or Stan did a nice job of putting us in Wallhead's perspective, which is like, if you get poked in the eye, you do not care if the referee saw you. That sucks. Like, that really sucks. And all that matters is your eye is like,
yeah,
is like hell right now. So my solution to this problem is you hire a replay coordinator. Fighters are allowed to stop the fight due to an illegal strike. But if on replay, this may be a bad idea. If on replay you see that it wasn't an eye poke and the fighter stopped it, the fight's over. You lose by TKO.
Well, I mean, this is the thing about the whole eye poke situation is, and I hope that there's some type of clarification. There needs to be, like, it should be treated like a groin strike.
Yeah. Well, there's two things to talk about here, right? It's one, can a fighter declare that an illegal strike took place? And two, the whole deal with thinking back to last week where the referee rushed the fighters to return. Like, it has to be treated like a groin strike, right, Jason? I mean, what's harder to come back from and what needs time, a groin strike or an eye poke? The answer is probably both.
Yeah, and I asked a regulator about this earlier this week, and they said it's totally up to the referee's discretion. You know, and you saw the way that Mark Goddard handled it last week, where it was this can you fight, can you fight, can you fight? You're trying to rush the fight to start, where I think there was, you know, the referee in the Wallhead fight was a little more like, okay, let's can you see, let's bring the doctor in, da-da-da. You know, I just think there needs to be a little clarification on the rule. But in speaking of that fight, Luan Chagas, a tremendous performance by him.
Yeah, there were a lot of good performances on the prelims. Some of the fights, the women's strawweight bout and the bantamweight bout, in the main event between Asuncion Moraes and Moyo Pedeta, those two fights were not very good. To me, everything else was really fun to watch. And Luan Chagas is one of the top performers to me. I expected Wallhead to win here. He certainly did not. And this was a lot about the stand-up game of Luan Chagas. He really controlled the bout here. He got hit with some shots, but he was fighting a guy who fights like a zombie. Wallhead is the fighter who gets hit a lot and he just continues to move forward, which is a difficult proposition. But this appeared to be a big development for Chagas, coming off the loss to, I think, Eric Silva was the one who beat him, yes. and that may have stunted his momentum. But in this welterweight bout, he looked really big. He looked very accurate. I don't know if the strategy of, like, looking down to your opponent's legs and going for, you know, feinting that you're going to go down. He did this a lot where he looked down at the feet, which gives Wallhead the idea that he's going to go with, like, a lower strike, and then he goes up with the punch. I don't know if that's the best idea, just to break eye contact with your opponent. And then it's almost like if you're going down, that means you're telling your opponent that you're going to go up. But anyways, he looked good. Bottom line, he's someone that showed big evolution fight to fight with this win over Jim Wallhead. And I do wonder if the eye poke had anything to do with the finish, but it really didn't. It was a really cool finish too, because he hit him with like a backhand almost. So Luan Chagas looked really good on the prelims, as did quite a few different fighters.
Yeah, I mean, I think you look at, obviously, Brian Kelleher's got to be one that jumps out to you, locking in that guillotine choke and pretty quick tap there by Yuri Alcantara, Matthew Lopez with what he did against John Eduardo, Antonio Carlos Jr., Eric Spicely. I didn't see that fight playing out the way it did, but kudos to Carlos Jr., and then, of course, Asuncion Moraes, which, as that fight ended, I think you even texted me, you said, you know, this has got split decision written all over it. I didn't see 30-27. When I heard that scorecard, I was like, huh? 30-27?
Yeah.
You didn't leave, I mean, I had the fight 29-28 for Moraes, but I think it's a very close fight and no issues if you have it for Rafael Asuncion. But, you know, Rafael Asuncion is just one of these guys that I just think it's tough to get excited for his fights.
Yeah, well, the big loser of that fight was Sean Shelby, right? Like, I can't believe we didn't talk about this beforehand, because I really hate saying this after a fight, because it's obvious after the fight takes place. Like, this was a bad matchup to do for Marlon Moraes. Heading into his a fighter with a lot of momentum, a lot of steam, very exciting striker, and, like, the cure to stunting momentum at bantamweight is putting them in a fight against Rafael Asuncion. He's one of the best 135 pounders in the world, and he's also not the most exciting fighter in the world. He has kind of a low output for 135, but he's very good. And this to me was and Sean Shelby and Nick Manor did a great job with matchmaking. I mean, but this was a bad one, right? Like, I just felt like he put a fighter in a division where you value – in any division you value new faces with momentum. And this was probably the worst potential matchup for Marlon Moraes.
I mean, look, I think it showed Marlon Moraes is one of the top bantamweights in the world. You know, talent-wise, you knew the talent was there. But the question was could his resume show he's a top five fighter? And, I wouldn't be surprised if they did Marlon Moraes and Brian Kelleher next.
Yeah, that would be. I mean, you're sacrificing name value against Kelleher, but Kelleher looked good. He slipped in the choke on Yuri Alcantara, and he had a couple Americans look good on the prelims against the poor Brazilians. Who was it? Was it Kelleher, the one that this got the crowd just completely?
Oh yeah, I was like, man, are you going to make it out of this country alive?
Yeah, dude, he did not care. I mean, he knew a little bit of Portuguese, I think.
But the crazy thing about Brian Kelleher, and I don't think we really talked about this on the pre-fight show, but heading into his UFC debut, this is a fighter that had trouble making 135 on the regional scene. Andre Sugumthau has talked about this, that they fought on the regional scene. He missed weight for his fight against Andre Sugumthau. When you go to his Tapology page, his fight back in March, he weighed 137.3. Fight before that, 138.8. Fight before that, 136.8. He had a catch weight of 140 pounds, weighed in 138 for his fight against, Sukumthal, which, always kind of made you wonder, if the UFC would bring him in at 135. But, look, a tremendous performance by Brian Kelleher. He wants a top 10 fighter. And when you go out and you beat a guy like Yuri Alcantara, that's kind of your best support for getting that top five fight, top 10 fight. A matchup against Andre Sukumthau, because there is a little backstory there, I think would make sense, but I think that's a fight at this stage that's not going to get Brian Kelleher interested, but a tremendous performance by him there. You mentioned, the preliminary card, kind of, overall a pretty good preliminary card. The feature matchup wasn't exactly the most exciting fight, but overall, I think as you look back at UFC 212, overall, I was fairly entertained.
Yeah, this was I've said this a couple times. Let's not lose sight of the fact that this card had very few fights that justify paying pay-per-view prices. With that being said, the card itself was very enjoyable. It peaked late with the main card. Basically, everything other than Belfort Marquardt was either entertaining or definitive. It was nice to see Marlon Moraes in the cage. I mean, that was a really high-level technical bout on the feet. Well, not high level, but it was good. Basically, what I'm saying, Jason, is I would have loved to have seen Marlon Moraes take on John Lineker. That's what I would have loved to have seen. But we may get that next. Who knows? I think he's got a messed up jaw, does Lineker, but he should be back soon. And then, speaking of high level, Eric Spicely, Antonio Carlos Jr. was just a high level grappling match. So,
yeah,
it was a fun night of fights. I will say sometimes you watch a Saturday night card and you question why you're watching it, why you're spending 7 hours. This was not the case. I will say that much. This delivered expectations, and I really fell in love with this main event fight. I mean, Aldo looked a little different than he did against Edgar. Not as active, not as fast, but still thought this was a fantastic fight. I thought he won the first two rounds, and I thought Holloway turned it on, got a definitive finish, won, and do a whole card in Hawaii, UFC. Holloway, Penn, and then Yancy Medeiros gave you a reason to want to see him fight again.
And, of course, the UFC has a card coming up on Saturday night, Sunday morning in New Zealand. UFC Fight Night 110 will be headlined by Derek Lewis versus Mark Hunt. Co-main event, Derek Brunson against Dan Kelly. Also, you got Dan Hooker versus Ross Pearson, Tim Elliott versus Ben Wynn. Nice little matchup there. In the flyweight division, of course, that's all coming up here Saturday night in the United States, a FS1 card. Of course, we're going to have a preview podcast later on this week for that fight card. And speaking of Ben Wynn, I actually had an interview with him here on this the most recent episode of the MMA Report podcast. So be sure to check that out. We're 3 weeks away from the Bellator pay-per-view, right around the corner. So
looking forward to it. I want to mention one thing, Jason. One thing before we go.
All right.
I want to give a shout out to Michael Schiavello. He hung up the mic this week. He great commentator, the big kibosh. It's good night, Irene. One time there was a guy named Manus fighting, and he kept on calling him Manus. And Michael Schiavello, he's one of my favorite commentators in the sport. And I remember, I mean, the relationship you have, I think, with commentators in mixed martial arts is unlike most national sports, because there's not many of them. They feel like it's like you are in this together. You love this sport that's developing. Schiavello is one of the OGs, man. I was just a kid, in high school, maybe late middle school. It had to have been high school, maybe middle school, watching him commentate for HDNet fights. And I grew up watching him bring us MMA from Japan and across the country and in Brazil at times. I think they did a couple Brazil cards, and he was awesome. Him and Miletic, a very underrated commentating duo. And I just wanted to give him a shout out, Jason. I think Schiavello is one of the best, and I think he's going back to Australia. You know, maybe one day he'll return to the sport, but I just wanted to give him a shout out because I just think he's fantastic.
And if anyone has not seen the knockout by Dominic Reyes from that Access card this past Friday night, you definitely check it out. A little bit of a viral clip. It's on every MMA website, so be sure to check that out. And I'll be interested to see kind of who ends up being the full-time guy there at Access TV, because in terms of MMA play-by-play guys, there's just not many of them out there. So, but we'll have a preview podcast later this week for UFC Fight Night 110. Also coming this week on the MMA Report podcast, I'll be joined by Matt Peterson, the matchmaker of New England Fights. We'll talk about their upcoming fight card. Also got a bunch of interviews I've got coming up this week. So be sure to check that out. So let's go wrap it up for this edition of the MMA Report post-fight podcast, which you always hear on RadioInfluence.com.
This is the Crush Report with Jeff Crushell.
Talent, mindset, grit, perseverance, and character, these are all very important concepts in the competitive world of business and sport. So important that we're now seeing a massive shift in talent ID and procurement away from just evaluating simple talent and skill to the analysis of psychometrics, the science of measuring mental processes. In fact, organizations and teams are now hiring so-called character coaches to help them break down and evaluate potential candidates in order to get just the right people and players on their teams. We're seeing it in the National Football League, in Major League Baseball, and a number of other major sports where money and performance go hand in hand. We're entering a new age where talent and skill are no longer the simple currency in high-performance sport or business. Leadership, aggressiveness, grit and perseverance, and other traits that were formerly referred to as the intangibles are now very tangible and will forevermore impact the process of talent ID. So, as you plan your training, map out your development, and look to the future with excitement and anticipation, remember to pay close attention to your psychometrics. They'll be in the spotlight as the recruiters, scouts, and coaches come in search of your talent. I'm Jeff Crushell, and this has been The Crush Report. Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. If you're a serious athlete, a weekend warrior, parent, or coach, join us each week as we investigate the latest trends and research coming out of the sport performance world. We'll visit with top athletes, coaches, and sports scientists to keep you on the cutting edge and to find out what it truly takes to achieve human maximum performance. You can visit us online at crushperformance.com, and Crush Performance Radio with me, Jeff Crushell, can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and at Radio Influence.